This is the Annex Wealth Management SWAT podcast. It is episode 95, Monday, March 18th, 2024. Strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats, insight and perspective from members of the Annex Wealth Management Investment Committee. Joining us today, Dr. Brian Jacobson in studio. He's chief economist.
It's great to be here.
On the line, Jason Cooper, research analyst. Welcome.
Thanks, Danny. And maybe to start, we can start off by thanking all of our listeners that come back week after week. If you like what you hear, please share this with a friend, colleague, or family member. We really enjoy making these, and your listening and spreading the word means a lot. So let's dive in.
You know, when I look back at last week, some of the data that came out, I think the highlights or maybe lowlights might have been like the inflation numbers, CPI, Consumer Price Index, and PPI, the Producer Price Index, both came in hotter than expected. Retail sales, marginally weaker. So I think that induced a little bit of volatility in the market. But when we look ahead, as far as what's coming down the road, we're really, at least for me, focused on the central bank statements that are going to come out this week. Tuesday, Bank of Japan, they have a policy announcement. Wednesday, Federal Open Market Committee, their rate decision is coming out. Bank of Japan, in my mind, is probably a little bit more important to the longer term trend for the markets because it is possible that they are going to abandon NERP, which is the negative interest rate policy. So their overnight rate is negative 0.1%. Now, they're also doing yield curve control, so YCC, and they might abandon that. So this could be a double barrel tightening of monetary policy coming out of Japan. And a lot of that is because just recently they went through their wage negotiations at a national level. Customs are different than what we have here in the United States as far as wage setting and the such. They tend to coordinate theirs a little bit more. And the largest union in Japan announced that they were able to secure a nearly 6% year-on-year increase in wages, which is the highest wage increase since like the early 1990s. So it's quite possible that they're going to abandon NERP and YCC. And then for the Fed, with the Federal Open Market Committee, they're going to be releasing their projections or their wild guesses for what they're going to do with monetary policy for the rest of the year. And based on the data that we've gotten in, I don't know, they could signal that maybe they're only going to do two rate cuts instead of the previously penciled in three. So it could be an interesting week ahead for us.
Brian, I mean, you highlighted this slight uptick in inflation. And then with respect to central banks, the importance that they'll have going forward, not just on inflation, but also on economic growth. One of the areas that has been really strong has been gold, which broke out to new all-time highs. So what do you think gold and even Bitcoin, which made a new high, are those sending the same signal, different signals? What's going on there?
Yeah, that's a great question. I've been really trying to figure that out. Is mainly what is the message that gold is signaling? When rates rise, you oftentimes see weakness for gold, not strength. And one of the reasons for that, if you think about the opportunity cost associated with holding gold, which doesn't generate any income, as yields go higher, people would tend to prefer to hold interest-bearing debt instead, but yet it has continued to move higher. And I think you could argue a similar thing about Bitcoin. Now, Bitcoin, in my mind, what it's doing is we're just witnessing price discovery. Right. It's like, OK, it had a price of nothing. We don't know what it was back, 20 years ago. So then it was launched. What is that equilibrium price? And at some point, it should probably get to a level in my mind where the price would then tend to increase with inflation. You know, so it's in finite supply. And so if you see the money supply increasing, the price of Bitcoin should probably, in my mind, probably go up in tandem with the increase in the money supply. But I mean, that's just my guess as far as the framework that I'm thinking about it in. And so right now with Bitcoin, I think it is that price discovery as far as, okay, at what level should it then maybe find a little bit of stability? Is it here at around 70,000 or is it back down around, I don't know, like 35,000? Who knows? With gold, though, how much of that is driven by, the fear factor? There's obviously all the conflict in the Middle East, continuing between Russia, Ukraine, possibility of conflict between Taiwan and China. We know central banks last year purchased a record amount of gold, so that was probably supporting the price. So, as far as the clear signals, I'm not sure there is a clear signal. I don't know. What's your take on it?
I honestly don't know, because you highlighted all the reason or the main reason why it should be lower, which is interest rates being higher. And then what the market is effectively starting to price in is that rates will have to be higher for longer. And you mentioned that maybe it's two cuts instead of three, but at the beginning of the year, the market was pricing in six.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a big change from a delta perspective for what the market has been pricing in. And despite that, rates are or gold has kind of rocketed to new all-time highs. So, I mean, one thing I guess you could say is maybe the market's becoming less convinced that we will have a soft landing from an inflation perspective. Instead of 2%, do we see 3%? Or
sure.
Is the Fed able to ultimately re-anchor inflation towards 2?
That's true. And maybe that's a great way to think about it, is it's almost a diversification play just in case it doesn't play out as maybe what the central tendency or central expectation is. If you don't get that soft landing, if you do get that re-acceleration of inflation, and so having a little bit of a bet on that, almost like a side bet, maybe that's what people are kind of perceiving it as. I think that maybe that's a good way to think about it. And when we think about the other sources of strength, you know, now thankfully, as in terms of that soft landing scenario, or maybe it's a no landing, I'm not quite sure exactly how people are defining this anymore. I view it as, are we going to have growth or not? And how strong will it be, or how weak will it be? And I view it as manufacturing might be finding its footing. We got the industrial production numbers out last week, and that did show that you had some real volatility from the super cold weather in January, where that really increased production for utilities, but decreased production kind of across the landscape for manufacturing. And then you got a bit of a bounce back and a reversal of that in February. So there's a little bit of noise, or maybe quite a bit of noise in there, but manufacturing is showing signs of maybe emerging from a recession. And as a result, if we do get some slight slowing in service sector activity, maybe the strength in manufacturing can help to offset any decline in activity from services. So I would view maybe as far as a strength, manufacturing beginning to find a bit of a footing. But, you know, in terms of from the markets, you highlighted gold doing quite well, Bitcoin. What about anything on the equity side? Did you notice any strength in the equity market? Seemed like it was kind of a really choppy week.
It was choppy, but I guess what I would highlight is given the weakness from the inflation reading perspective, so inflation being higher and how that manifested in higher bond yields, you would have really expected it to be an even weak week for stocks. So in the absence of that weakness that you would expect, it's actually strong on a relative basis. I mean, the opportunity cost for holding stocks is similar to the opportunity cost for holding fixed income instruments. You tend to discount cash flows based on the prevailing level of interest rates. So higher interest rates typically translate to maybe a more conservative valuation on securities. So the only area where we really saw pronounced weakness was in small caps, and that's probably due to their balance sheets, but that's more of a focus, I would say, for our weaknesses section.
True. And actually, yeah, maybe that's a good transition is as far as what the weaknesses on the macro side. Clearly, the strength in inflation is a weakness overall, I think, as far as the current conditions, as far as where we are, because this is backwards looking. So remember, markets try to anticipate what will happen much more so than reacting to what has happened, unless, of course, what has happened is a big surprise. It's kind of like when you're driving and you're mapping something out, right? You can have a surprise as to where you are going to go, but then also a surprise about where you are. And I have found that a few times when I've been driving around. I'm like, oh, I thought I was a little bit closer to the destination than what I was. And this was a bit of a step backwards, perhaps, with that strong CPI and PPI. And now, thankfully, despite that, it seems as though the credit fundamentals of a lot of businesses in the investment grade space, maybe the high yield space as well, still mostly intact. So I would argue that right now, the weaknesses, especially on the fixed income side of things, we did see that big move up in the 10-year treasury yield. So that was clearly painful, but it was a much smoother ride if you were in high yield, which is somewhat perplexing. Oftentimes you expect that to amplify the volatility. This time was a bit of a dampener, which was kind of nice. So the weakness, though, I would say that right now it looks like things are okay, but there are some early signs of deterioration. What are you seeing in terms of small caps versus large caps, perhaps, in terms of earnings and balance sheets?
I guess tying those two together, the weakness that I would point out is that a lot of small cap securities have variable interest rate debt on their balance sheet, or are at least more dominated by variable interest rate debt. So the prospect of having higher interest rates for longer directly translates to them having a higher level of interest expense on a go-forward basis. And when we look at the term structure, so I guess when a lot of these variable notes start to roll over, it's really going to start hitting between 2025 and 2027. Mm-hmm. So you have companies that have had pretty persistently depressed earnings, which impacts them on a go-forward basis because maybe they're less competitive since the higher level of interest impacts their ability to generate cash flow, so they're not investing as heavily. So now you kind of have a company that's on a back foot. You have a company that's on a back foot, they're going to creditors asking for additional debt or to roll over a term loan. They might get not the most favorable terms. Mm-hmm. So it is almost like this slow motion train wreck for any company that came to the market, you know, expecting rates to remain lower for longer and wasn't financially responsible. And for that reason, it's so important for a security analyst to really parse through the indebtedness. Is it variable or fixed? Can a company survive should interest rates remain in this higher for longer regimen? And then on the flip side, the opportunity is if we ever to go through a rapid rate cutting cycle, barring some significant deterioration in the economy, which I'm not sure how likely that is, the operating leverage for those businesses would be enormous. So you'd expect them to rip pretty heavily.
Well, that's a good point. Yeah, you've got operating leverage and financial leverage. It seems like over the last couple of years, especially in the large cap space, a lot of CEOs were talking about how they were anticipating a recession. So perhaps they right-sized their operations. That's a bit of a euphemism for maybe slowed hiring and slowed investment and the such. But maybe they have a lot of operating leverage. And then it's a question of the financial leverage and their ability to take on financial leverage. And that's how you can get that big gap between the top line revenue and the bottom line earnings. Some of the ways in which you can have, you know, the sales growth at, say, 2%, if not sometimes declining, but yet earnings growth of like 20%. It's because of everything that happens in between, which is a function of their operating leverage and their financial leverage. So it seems like this is a great environment for analysts to sift through. And I think you highlight something really important. Even if you are just focusing on the equity part of investing, you have to be aware of the whole capital structure, right? It's not just about, oh, what's, do I like the stock? Well, you know, kind of peel that back a little bit about why and take a look at the on the fixed income side too. How are they financed? What does that whole picture look like?
Yeah. And Brian, I had a question for you actually, just with respect to weaknesses. We just had the expiration of the Bank Term Funding Program. And at the same time, we've had this backup in yields on the long end of the curve. So do you think that increases the likelihood that there will be a decrease in lending going forward?
Yes, I think that is a high risk, especially for smaller businesses, where they tend to be more reliant on banks for funding. So small and medium-sized enterprises, this is where a lot of the private credit industry is trying to step in and maybe fill the void that has already formed and is likely to get bigger as banks try to clean up their balance sheets. Because you're correct, now that these banks can't go use the Bank Term Funding Program, which was the program that was set up last year when Silicon Valley Bank, when, you know, they kind of imploded as a result of the decline in the value of their treasury securities. Banks can't just go there to the Fed and get that money at a low cost anymore. And so where else are they going to get it from? Well, if they can't get it from depositors, they might actually have to maybe shrink their balance sheet as far as with the assets. So I think that there are going to be some challenges, mostly affecting commercial real estate, maybe small and medium-sized enterprises. A lot of small businesses, it seems like they're viewing it as easier, perhaps a little bit cheaper, just because of the risk sharing involved, to raise equity instead of debt. And when I think about, you know, if you're going to be running a business, oftentimes debt is the cheapest form of financing. But now a lot of businesses are shifting more towards equity. And I wonder if it's because, number one, the fixed income or the debt It creates this commitment, right? It increases the bankruptcy risks. If there's equity, sure, it might be a higher cost right now as far as the explicit, you know, percentage rate of return investors are expecting, but it at least helps mitigate some of those bankruptcy risks. On that cheerful note, maybe we should shift towards opportunities, right? Lots of cross-country divergences. At the intro, I was talking about Bank of Japan and the Federal Reserve meeting. I think that's going to create some really interesting cross-country divergences here, especially on the currency side. The Bank of Japan decides to abandon both negative interest rates and yield curve control, or at least relax yield curve control. We could probably see the yen strengthen, which, you know, if you're investing in Japan, so if you're a U.S. investor and you own stock in a Japanese company, if the currency, if their currency goes up in value, that's kind of like a double-barreled benefit for you because you made a bet on the company and also on the currency. So, you know, that could be interesting, but a lot of Japanese companies, they export. And so
I was going to say, you got to be selective there.
You do, absolutely, because if that currency goes up in value, what does that actually do to the fundamentals of those businesses? Similar story in the UK, very export-oriented. And so if the British pound goes up in value, you typically see their stock market go down. So it has that inverse relationship. In the United States, it's a little bit different, mainly because of it doesn't have the same export orientation for, you know, the broad market as what you have in Japan and the United Kingdom. But lots of cross-country divergences. I think that one of the great opportunities for investors is to just kind of reassess where they are with their allocations, especially between U.S. versus non-U.S. Is it aligned with those longer-term goals that you have? You know, if you think about, let's say, the MSCI, the All-Country World Index, which is one that we like to use because it's the, you know, kind of entire investable market universe, it is biased towards the United States, but that home bias, I don't know, maybe that still has an opportunity here in the near term as we kind of ride through some of these cross currents that we might be encountering.
Another area that's kind of opportunistic, even looking at our markets, what's been fantastic about this earnings season is that generally you've seen companies pretty much beat expectation and analysts have been revising their estimates higher, not just for this year, but even for next year. So if you're looking at 2025 now, you're seeing 13.3% growth in earnings over the next year. Mm. We're looking at 2025 estimates of like $276. And even though the market's expensive now, trading at you know, more than 20 times forward earnings, over the last 5 years, it has averaged 19. Mm-hmm. So even if we were to exit this year trading at 19 times earnings and analyst estimates stabilized, we still have a couple percent upside in the market for the rest of the year. But given the amount of macro factors, it probably is going to be accompanied by a little bit of volatility.
Interesting. So perhaps some room to run, but not a lot of room, or as much room as maybe a year ago. What about some of the threats? You know, one of the biggest threats, I'm reminded of Yogi Berra when he had said about, he was giving directions to one of his friends to go to his house, and he said, when you come to the fork in the road, take it. Which is kind of like, okay, well, what sort of guidance is that? Should I go left or should I go right? But it was because actually it didn't matter. Whichever fork you took, you got to his house because they reconverged. And so it's kind of a funny backstory there. But I think about the fork in the road that we have here as far as with U.S. monetary policy versus Japanese monetary policy. And then there's all sorts of other almost forks in the road as far as, is manufacturing going to make that turn or not? Will Europe emerge from their protracted recession or not? Will China be able to stimulate growth or not? I mean, to me, there's a lot of these forks in the road, and I'm not quite sure, you know, with great confidence as to which one to really take. And in the near term, there's that possibility of that giant sucking sound of liquidity coming out of the markets if Japan does abandon the negative interest rate policy and yield curve control. There's the whole possibility of the unwinding of something called the carry trade, where levered investors would go borrow in Japan at incredibly low rates, invest elsewhere. And if those rates begin to go up, the extent to which they need to basically kind of, I guess, unwind some of those trades, the extent to which that's going to create some ripples or perhaps waves across the investment landscape. So that's probably one of the biggest threats that I'm really watching.
Yeah, and Buffett was a master at playing that threat. He took out a lot of Japanese denominated debt for Berkshire. bought a bunch of Japanese stocks. So you think about it, there's the prospect that those businesses, which I think are trading companies, so they're not really manufacturing, so not highly export intensive, say the yen appreciates, it's not really going to impact his ability to access capital either by selling those shares or by receiving the dividends and taking those sums to pay off the debt. But in the meantime, he locked in effectively 0% interest rates in order to make those investments. Who doesn't love free money?
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, the golden handcuffs that households have with the low mortgage rates and the golden handcuffs he has now with the low Japanese borrowing rates that he had.
Yeah, and besides for that, I mean, we talked about a couple percentage points upside for the market for the rest of the year. It's been pretty easy though, right? For the last couple of months, you kind of just sit back and watch the number go up on your screen. Could be a shock to investors if volatility returns, and there are certainly a lot of reasons. I mean, you highlighted the carry trade unwinding, but there are numerous reasons that volatility can return, and oftentimes the volatility returns for a reason that no one predicts.
That's right.
So,
at the end of our episodes, we always check our headlines. What's this week's headline strength?
Perhaps manufacturing beginning to find a footing in the United States.
Headline weakness.
It's all about inflation.
Headline opportunity.
These cross-country divergences create opportunities.
Headline threat.
That giant sucking sound is liquidity.
Jason Cooper, research analyst, thank you.
Thank you, Danny.
Dr. Brian Jacobson, chief economist at Annex Wealth Management, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. That's episode 95 of the Annex Wealth Management SWAT Podcast. Annex Wealth Management, LLC, is a registered investment advisor. For more information about our firm, please visit annexwealth.com. The information in this podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only and is subject to change without notice. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and don't necessarily reflect on those of Annex Wealth Management, LLC. Information presented should not be construed as tax, legal, or investment advice, or a recommendation or a solicitation for the sale of any product or strategy. Listeners are encouraged to seek advice from qualified professionals to determine whether any information presented may be suitable for their specific situation. Investments involve risk. Neither Annex Wealth Management, LLC, nor its podcast participants shall be liable for losses resulting from decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on this podcast.